Wall Street to America. Heads we win, tails you lose.
What happened since the financial crisis, and why I write about a subversion of democracy, is that private obligations became public obligations. So, heads I win, tails you lose. If the bank makes money, the bankers get the money. The bankers get the profit. If the bank loses money, taxpayer makes up for it. This is the essence of too big to fail, and why too big to fail is considered unfair.
That's financial journalist Bob Ivry. We spend the hour with him talking about his book, The Seven Sins of Wall Street, Big Banks, Their Washington Lackeys, and the Next Financial Crisis. We also have some suggestions for summer reading. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When it comes to crying needs like affordable housing, healthcare, living wages, cleaning up the environment, and supporting schools, we always hear, there just isn't enough money. But when it looked like the big banks were about to go under in 2008, the U.S. government had no trouble rustling up $750 billion in a couple of days to bail them out. Over the years since, the Federal Reserve has added several trillion to that, practically giving money away to the banks and then buying it back at a higher price. Banks and their casino economy are even bigger now than before. Now they're not just betting on subprime mortgages, but on commodities like electricity and metals that determine the prices of basic goods. And as always, the U.S. taxpayer is on the hook for bailing them out when things go wrong. My guest, Bloomberg financial reporter Bob Ivry, says it all amounts to a leveraged buyout of the U.S., where Wall Street is making out like bandits while the rest of us shoulder the risk. In his terrific book, The Seven Sins of Wall Street, Ivry lays out in scorching prose what's been happening since 2008 and why we're headed for another financial meltdown unless we break up the big banks and put an end to too big to fail. Ivry skewers the banks and the feds while sharing the compelling stories of whistleblowers and ordinary Americans who fought back against corruption and injustice. Bob Ivry is an investigative reporter for Bloomberg News. His articles have won numerous awards, including the George Polk Award in 2009. BusinessInsider.com recently named Ivry one of the 101 finance people you have to follow on Twitter. I spoke to him in May, before two foreign banks, Credit Suisse and French bank BNP Paribas, settled criminal charges with the U.S. Department of Justice. The case came into our conversation, but the story has advanced since then. Bob Ivry, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me.
In this wonderful book, Seven Sins of Wall Street, you write that the financial crisis that we went through, the meltdown of 2008, we call it a financial crisis, you say, but you say it was really a leveraged buyout of the United States. What do you mean by that?
There's an expression in banking, and it's credited to the billionaire J. Paul Getty. And he said, if you borrow $10,000 from the bank owns you. But if you borrow $10 billion from the bank, you own the bank. These banks, these six banks that I talk about in Seven Sins of Wall Street, borrowed a lot more than $10 billion from the United States government and the Federal Reserve. And it is was in the best interests of the government and the Federal Reserve that these banks not only survive but flourish. And the Federal Reserve and the U.S. government have done all they could and more to make sure that the banks thrived, even as the rest of America didn't.
We haven't even recovered on the housing front yet.
Well, you see that the houses that are the upper end of the price scale are doing very well. And the homes that are in the middle of the price scale and at the low end of the price scale aren't doing that well. And that should give you an indication of really what's happened since the 2008 financial crisis. There's been, I call it economic apartheid in the book, and I think that's kind of an incendiary expression. But I think that more as we get farther and farther away from 2008, I think you can actually say that, and it's an accurate description.
Say a little bit more about that.
Well, you really have had two economic recoveries in this country, one that's gone apace and the other that hasn't. It's lagged. And you see that in the work of Tom Piketty, the French economist, who has just written a very good book about that. I've read most of it. I haven't read all of it yet. But he describes that there really was an acceleration after 2008 of income inequality. Wealth, we've always had that. We've always had wealth inequality. But now, ever since the financial crisis, we've had an acceleration in the widening of the gap. So you see that the U.S. government and the Federal Reserve decided very early on that in order to get the country's economy going, they needed to stimulate the banks. That's the decision they made, and it worked out well for the banks. It hasn't yet really worked out all that well for the rest of us.
We started out talking about housing. Mortgages is one of the topics of your book, The Seven Sins of Wall Street. The U.S. taxpayer guarantees 9/10 of the mortgages. How do we come to that pass?
As I say in the book, mortgages before the crisis of 2008 were really royally screwed up by the banks and by the government. Since then, probably more so, and I mean more screwed up by the banks and the government. One of the things that precipitated the crisis was Wall Street making loans to people who couldn't pay them back, bundling all those loans into investments that they then sold around the world. And when more and more people couldn't pay back their mortgages, those investments collapsed and led to a chain reaction that nearly brought down the entire financial system of the world. Since then, we've been living with that legacy. And what happened was that the Wall Street decided that they weren't going to do that anymore. That left it to the United States government to be the guarantor of all those mortgages. So what we've had is the taxpayers have basically taken on not only the liabilities of the biggest banks, but have also slipped into the role that the banks used to have, and the banks and also mortgage insurance companies like AIG and other mortgage, for instance, mortgage banks like AmeriQuest, Countrywide, which in the early part of the 2000s were notorious for their fraudulent practices. So what's happened since then, because we still want people to buy homes, we still want people to be able to borrow money to buy homes, is the U.S. government has stepped into that role. And so that's how we find ourselves in this predicament now, is that how do you have a financial system where people are able to borrow money to buy homes without the private sector really being involved anymore? The public sector has moved in and done that.
And is the public sector doing any better in some ways than the private sector? That is, are people being able to get mortgages that they actually can pay back? And how does that kind of intersect? I mean, it seems that there's a little bit of an ongoing collision between the fact that incomes are not rising and people are still trying to get homes.
It's interesting because my colleagues at Bloomberg News had an article this week about how people are rating 401ks, their retirement funds. And they called the retirement funds the home equity of the 2010s. What happened because of stagnant wages for the middle class and the working class was people would use the appreciating value of their homes as a way to keep their standard of living improving. So if they wanted to pay for juniors' college education, or they wanted to buy a boat to enjoy themselves in the summers, or a vacation, or maybe they needed to put a new bathroom and a kitchen in their house, they would take out a home equity loan, which was just fine because home prices were always going up. When home prices stopped going up, that's when the crash basically happened. So now, without that home equity cushion that people have, they don't have that equity in their homes anymore. Home prices are not going up enough for them to make up for what they lost. They're raiding their retirement funds. I'm going to tell you one more story, and it's included in The Seven Sins of Wall Street. I became acquainted with a whistleblower for Citigroup, City Mortgage. Her name's Sherry Hunt. And she was in charge of making sure that Citigroup was buying and selling mortgages that were up to snuff. And anytime there would be a, she would take a sampling of the mortgages and take a look and see if it had all the regular, all the paperwork that she needed. Because if it didn't have the paperwork or it didn't have certain things signed or the bank account that was in the mortgage application didn't match your employer or your name or what, she would flag fraud and she would just flag mortgage applications that were incomplete because those mortgages might not be kosher.
So these are those kind of the liar loans.
Some of them were the liar loans, but it was more that if there's whiteout, because what City Mortgage did was it would buy mortgages from independent brokers who weren't always on the up and up. And she had identified maybe 60% of the mortgages coming in for Citigroup to be shady. And what Citigroup was doing with these mortgages was it had a relationship with the Federal Housing Administration. And it would get guarantees from the FHA that if the borrower quit paying, the federal government in the form of the U.S. taxpayer would come in and make up the difference. And so these loans were guaranteed by the U.S. taxpayer. And it was up to Citigroup to say that these mortgages were fine and good and give them the stamp of approval and let the FHA guarantee them. A lot of them were not good, and Citigroup was actually had pleaded guilty to defrauding the FHA. So I went to the FHA and I said, what's up? I talked to the general counsel there, and she said from 2009, when she first got there, until March 2012, when I talked to her, the FHA didn't really check any of those mortgages. It relied on Citigroup and the other FHA lenders, Wells Fargo, JP Morgan Chase, the big boys. Everybody knows who they are, the big mortgage companies, Bank of America. And this was astounding to me that the taxpayer could be on the hook for billions of dollars, but at the same time, the watchdog for the taxpayer, the FHA, didn't bother to check that the mortgages that the taxpayer was guaranteeing were any good. And she assured me that starting about that time, that they would start checking the mortgages that were coming in. But I'd like to circle around with some of Sherry Hunt's colleagues and find out if that's true.
And you haven't done that yet, but what happened to Sherry Hunt?
Sherry Hunt, you know, it's very difficult to win one of these lawsuits. She sued Citigroup as an employee under the QI-TAM provision. QI-TAM provision comes out of the Civil War, and it says that an employee whistleblower of a company, if it sees and has evidence that the company is defrauding the U.S. government, can sue that company on behalf of the taxpayer. A lot of these suits happen. Very few of them succeed. One thing that improves their chances of succeeding is if the Department of Justice comes in and sues alongside the whistleblower. Sherry Hunt had amassed such a volume of evidence against Citigroup, so detailed, and so damning, that the Department of Justice came in and sued Citigroup along with her. They won the lawsuit. Citigroup had to pay back, I think, $170 million, and Sherry Hunt got $31 million of that as a reward before taxes and her lawyer's fees. But this was a working-class woman who did not have a college education, who just decided that right was more important than her career, and she really did risk her career. She could easily have been fired and forgotten, and she would be working who knows where at a convenience store or something like that. But she did risk it all because she felt that being right matters more than being rich.
And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Bob Ivry about his book, Seven Sins of Wall Street, Big Banks, Their Washington Lackeys, and the Next Financial Crisis, which we will get to. Now, the Dodd-Frank bill was supposed to address the problem of too big to fail, to basically take the taxpayer off the hook, and to prevent future financial meltdowns. What's happened with Dodd-Frank?
What's happened with Dodd-Frankenstein? A lot has happened with Dodd-Frankenstein because it's, depending on how big your font size is, it's 700 pages or 1,000 pages. What I like to say is the Obama administration never saw a problem that they didn't want to throw a committee at. So what Dodd-Frank does is it lays out the parameters of what they want financial regulation to do post-crisis, post-2008 crisis. And then it leaves it up to the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, all these regulatory bodies to make up the details of the rules. What that's really done since 2009, or actually 2010 was when Dodd-Frank went through, is allowed the banks to pay lobbyists lots and lots of money to try to influence the details of the regulation. I think that a lot of folks who I agree with on a lot of other things are very excited about Dodd-Frank and think that it's done a lot to ameliorate the whole problem of too big to fail. Now, too big to fail, all that means is that the U.S. government can't afford to let one of these big banks go under, because if they did, it would imperil the entire financial system of the world. One of the corollaries of too big to fail is too big to jail. And Attorney General Eric Holder in 2013 told the Senate that he was worried about prosecuting any of the banks because they were too big. And he was afraid that any ill effects of that prosecution would ripple through the financial system and really cause damage to ordinary people who needed a loan or wanted to get their money out of the ATM. He since, a year later, almost to the day, says, well, wait a second. We're going to try to prosecute one of the banks. The two banks that he is reputed to be going after are Credit Suisse, which is a Swiss bank, and BNP Paribas, which is a French bank, for what they've done in the United States as far as, I believe, money laundering and tax havens for American citizens. What he hasn't done is, well, he hasn't done it yet anyway, and it remains to be seen whether they really truly will prosecute those banks. But he hasn't said that he would go after an American bank for doing the exact same things. And there are American banks that have done the exact same things. So did Dodd-Frank get rid of too big to fail? I'm going to reflect that question back to you. If Citigroup, which handles the overseas accounts of the U.S. government, were to suddenly get in trouble over some weird investment, or J.P. Morgan Chase were to take savings account money from American citizens who put their money in savings accounts in Chase branches and lose billions of dollars on very complicated, kind of silly bets on whether or not, say, American Airlines is going to go under, and loses this truckload of money, teeters on the edge of failure. Do you think that the U.S. government will allow capitalism to proceed as it usually does, where badly managed or bad luck companies go under naturally, and their shareholders lose everything, and their bondholders fight over what's left, the desks and the buildings, and they liquidate and send it over to the people who've lent money to this bank? Do you think the U.S. government and the Federal Reserve will allow that to happen? I'll say no. I don't think that too big to fail has been solved. I think we still have that problem.
One question that I have on this issue is, why don't they just jail? I mean, back in the, you know, under the Bush administration, you had the famous perp walk. You had a bunch of guys who went to jail. It didn't crash the economy. And in some cases, it didn't even crash the company. So what I don't understand is, are they really sincere about this? Well, you know, we don't want to prosecute these banks because we're afraid of what it's going to do to the economy. Why don't they just prosecute some of the guys at the head of it?
I can give you a cynical response, and that is that it's really provided by our own Congress. If you go back a couple of years to when Chase lost at least $6 billion on a scenario very close to what I just described, taking the savings accounts of ordinary Americans and kind of putting it on black and letting the roulette wheel spin and then losing the money. We don't know how much they lost because they won't account for it, but it's at least $6.2 billion. And they hauled the CEO of the company, Jamie Dimon, for hearings at both the Congress and the Senate. And the senators ended up asking him for investment advice. I'm not sure why we should be puzzled that the executive branch of our government doesn't go after these guys, because a lot of them want jobs with these guys after they get out of their government service. If not them, then law firms that do a lot of business with them. I wish I could be less cynical about this, but that's really how I see it.
Like the law firm that Eric Holder comes from, Covington Burley, is that it?
That's right.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Bob Ivry about his book, The Seven Sins of Wall Street, Big Banks, Their Washington Lackeys, and The Next Financial Crisis. So the Federal Reserve is something that you go into to a great extent in The Seven Sins of Wall Street. And I have to say, I have not understood what the Federal Reserve was doing well until I read your book. It was a really fascinating story that you tell. You say that Ben Bernanke actually reshaped the U.S. financial system. How did he do that?
Well, thank you for that. That's very nice. I did write the book for folks who aren't, you know, neck deep in the financial industry. I wanted smart people everywhere to figure out the details. The Federal Reserve is the bank for banks. It lends money to the banks. It holds money for banks in accounts, savings accounts that are similar to savings accounts. And it tells the banks when they should be lending and more, when they should be lending less. And it slaps the banks on the wrist when they do things that aren't kosher. Ben Bernanke was the chairman of the Federal Reserve, the head guy in charge, probably the most powerful financial person in the world for 8 years under two presidents. He was nominated for that job by George W. Bush, and then he was renominated by Barack Obama. And when I say he reshaped the financial system, what he did after the financial crisis, and my book, The Seven Sins of Wall Street, really does focus on what happened after the financial crisis, is he decided to keep the bailout going. And it's not a very complicated process. It sounds complicated when the financial press and the folks in the financial industry start talking about it. But it's a policy called quantitative easing. And all it means is that the Federal Reserve, the bank for banks, is going to buy bonds from the banks. And what this does is it puts cash, fresh cash, into the financial system. Now, it's not paying the banks. It's not giving away the money. It is buying securities. What securities? It's buying mortgages, mortgage-backed securities, to keep the mortgage industry going. And it's buying treasuries. So what happens is the treasury, the U.S. government, issues debt. It's going to borrow some money. So they issue bonds. The banks buy the bonds, lending money to the treasury. And then the Federal Reserve buys those bonds from the banks. So the banks lend money and then get money. So there's a lot of cash now. It's not tied up in securities anymore. It's not tied up in an investment like a treasury bond or a mortgage-backed bond. It's cash. And a lot of that cash is sloshing through the banking system. What Ben Bernanke thought was it would trickle down into the broader economy through loans mostly, or direct investment in some cases. But it didn't. That's because the banks like to have some money. That's what bankers are in the business for. They like money. And this was really cheap money.
And how is it cheap money? I mean, how does this work out that the banks are getting some kind of advantageous spread?
Well, they get to, you know, you're talking about a spread, right? So they'll buy, they're buying low and they're selling higher.
To the U.S. government? They're buying low from the U.S. government and selling high back to the government?
Yeah, the government is the government is able to borrow money from the banks. and then have the banks then sell those bonds or that debt back to the Federal Reserve. And let's not make the mistake and say that the Federal Reserve is part of the U.S. government, because it really, really isn't. It's something different. The Federal Reserve is its own thing. And one of the things that came out of 2008 was, if you didn't already realize how unaccountable the Federal Reserve is to Washington and to the taxpayers, you really knew that after 2008 and 9, because the Federal Reserve is only accountable to the banks. The big banks and the other banks in the country own shares. So you're really talking about a closed loop of the banking system.
But the Federal Reserve is printing U.S. money, isn't it? I mean, that's what people say. The Federal Reserve is printing U.S. dollars.
What they mean is that the Federal Reserve is buying these bonds from the banks and sending them cash. There's another component to it, and it's called ZIRP. ZIRP stands for Zero Interest Rate Policy. What the Federal Reserve did in December 2008 was it set the benchmark interest rate, the rate that banks lend to each other, at which banks lend to each other, at near zero. So what that did was, that's what made money so cheap. So the banks could borrow money at 0.25% and then pay you in your bank, in your check savings account, 0.01%. And that was what was happening in 2012, was your bank account, your savings account, was paying you 0.01%. The banks were able to buy and sell money for very, very cheap. The cost of funding, they call it in banking, was very low and has remained low. And this is the upshot of that, is that 5.5 years later, the interest rates are still near zero. This is an unprecedented experiment in monetary policy. This has never happened before, that the Federal Reserve has set interest rates at near zero, meaning that those folks who are on the upper part of the pyramid can get their money nearly for free.
So you say that this has led to some inflation. Am I right about that?
This is some controversy, and I've worked with people, very smart people, who say, oh, you know, you're telling me about inflation. You know, anybody who's taken Economics 101 in college, which I didn't do, by the way, but every one of them will tell you, you put more money into the system, that means that there's going to be inflation because you have more money. You're going to have higher wages. You're going to have higher prices. You're going to have more demand for goods and services, and that's going to push the prices of everything up. Well, we haven't seen that. Not really. Now, I happen to think that, and this is a minority opinion, and you can call me a crackpot for saying this, but I think that some of the data that the Federal Reserve uses to set their policy, in other words, certain numbers that Janet Yellen, who's now the chairperson of the Federal Reserve, that she looks at before she decides what monetary policy will be, I think they're a little off. For instance, it seems to me that with college education costs going up every year, with the cost of healthcare going up every year, and other things going up, the price going up every year, that there should be inflation. What I am told by people who are much smarter than me is that wages haven't gone up. And when wages start to go up, which seems to be the case perhaps now in May of 2014, that wages are starting to go up, you're going to start to see inflation. How much inflation? I had a very, very smart colleague in 2009 who told me he saw hyperinflation in the future. Hyperinflation's really dangerous because that means that people on fixed incomes, for instance, go broke. They go hungry. And just in my very surface study of financial history of the 20th century, it seems that hyperinflation is what's caused a lot of civil unrest, more so than just about any other financial calamity.
Bob Ivry. His book is The Seven Sins of Wall Street: Big Banks, Their Washington Lackeys, and the Next Financial Crisis. We'll talk more after the break. Don't go away.
You're gonna break another heart. You're gonna tell another lie. Here I am, and there you go, you're gone again. I know you're gonna be the way you've always been. Breaking hearts and telling lies is all you know. Another guy gives you the eye. There you go. There you go. You're gone again. I should have known I couldn't win. There you go.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're spending most of the hour today with financial reporter Bob Ivry. His book, The Seven Sins of Wall Street, is a ferociously tragicomic expose of how the U.S. taxpayers' bailout of Wall Street has resulted in the big banks getting bigger, our economy more fragile, and ordinary Americans more at risk. Writer and former financial analyst Nomi Prince said, "Ivry's voice is appropriately sardonic and exasperated, his journalism and research impeccable." Now, this is also a story about financial journalism, which is just fascinating as well. Finding out what the Federal Reserve, the banks, and the U.S. government really wants to keep secret. Tell us about your colleague Mark Pittman, along with Bloomberg here, suing the Federal Reserve to find out how much the Fed had actually given the banks. And the numbers are staggering.
Yeah, you know, when we talk about financial bailout, we usually talk about TARP. It's the Troubled Asset Relief Program, and it was administered by the U.S. Treasury under Secretary Henry Paulson. And that was for $700 billion to lend banks money in order to get through a tough patch. The Federal Reserve, on the other hand, lent out $1.2 trillion on a single day in December of 2008. But we wouldn't have known that if it hadn't been for Mark Pittman. Now, Mark Pittman was a reporter at Bloomberg News, a colleague of mine, and a frequent co-author of articles. He said, "You know what? We know the Federal Reserve is lending money out because the number is reported every week in aggregate on the Fed's website." The Fed would say, basically, and I'm shorthanding it here a little bit, "We lent out $400 billion this week." They didn't say to who, and they didn't say to how much to who, just an aggregate number. Mark said, "Well, this is our money, and we really should know." So he made what's called a FOIA request. It's Freedom of Information Act from the 1960s, and allows citizens and reporters to petition the executive branch of the federal government. And there's local laws that govern local governments, but this was the Federal Freedom of Information Act. And you could ask them to provide information that should be public but isn't. They turned Mark down twice, and Mark went to his editor, and the editor went to the lawyer, and the editor also went to his or her boss. And together they decided to sue the Federal Reserve to find out exactly how much the bailouts were, the details of it, which banks were borrowing money, for how much. And it took 2 years to wind through the courts. The courts never ruled against Bloomberg and Mark Pittman. The courts unanimously, three of them, said that the public interest of knowing this outweighed any kind of stigma that might attach to a bank that was borrowing money from the Federal Reserve.
Which was the argument of the Federal Reserve.
The Federal Reserve said that if you knew who was borrowing, then that bank would be stigmatized, that counterparties would pull their deals, that depositors would pull their deposits, that lenders would pull their lines of credit and stop lending. And the court said, no, there's a public interest to knowing this. And finally, the Federal Reserve decided not to fight it all the way to the Supreme Court. What had happened was, after the first court case that the Federal Reserve lost, the big banks, in the form of an organization called the Clearinghouse, joined the Federal Reserve in the suit. So the Federal Reserve and the biggest banks in the country, their interests were now clearly aligned in court. And Bloomberg, this poor little organization, this media organization with billions of dollars behind it and the world's best lawyers and probably the best financial reporter in the country, Mark Pittman, prevailed. And unfortunately, Mark died before the case was settled. He died in November 2009, and the case wasn't settled till much later. But we were able to, because of his work and because of the Freedom of Information Act, we were able to show that the CEOs of all six of the biggest banks in the United States basically lied to their investors and to the public about the health of their organizations. We could show, for instance, that Ken Lewis, who was the CEO of Bank of America, was telling investors that everything was peachy with his bank, and that same week, he had $60 billion out in loans from the Federal Reserve. Now, these loans are meant to help banks get over a hump, a bad patch. A liquidity shortage is what they call it in the banking system. But what we could see was a pattern that even the biggest banks, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan Chase, Morgan Stanley, these were really, really big liquidity problems. In other words, when you borrow $100 billion on a single day, like Morgan Stanley did, or $98 billion, like Bank of America did, or $95 billion, like Citigroup did, what you've done, basically, is you have reshaped the financial system to say, it doesn't matter how much you screw up, we're going to bail you out. And this was Mark Pittman's gift and Bloomberg News's gift to the knowledge we have about 2008 and 2009.
If they're getting so much money and they're being underwritten by the U.S. taxpayer and they've got this great advantageous spread between, you know, the money that they're borrowing and what they're selling back to the Federal Reserve or to the U.S. government, well, why wouldn't they keep on borrowing this money at such a cheap amount, even if they are healthy, because they're making money off of it? I mean, is it really that they're not healthy, or is it just that they're gaming the system because they know it's such a sweet deal?
I think that's a very smart question, and I think it's something that we talked about and we wrote about in 2009, 2010, 2011, because, you know, you had different programs that the Federal Reserve ran. This wasn't just, you know, you belly up to the window and you say, I need $100 billion, and they give it to you. There were many different programs designed to save certain industries and to help the banks in certain sectors of their functioning. For instance, the Federal Reserve wanted to stimulate mortgage borrowing, so it had a program where it would, if you used your mortgage bonds as collateral, it would lend you money for very, very cheap. We found out that Goldman Sachs had borrowed, I think it was $15 billion. It was a $15 billion loan from the Federal Reserve in exchange for mortgage-backed securities as collateral. And this, in theory, would make Goldman go out and buy more mortgages in order to have collateral to get this loan. And they were getting this loan for, believe it or not, 0.01% interest. So it was as close to free money as you possibly can. And our discussions at Bloomberg News about this was, do you really think that Goldman needed this $15 billion, or they just saw this opportunity to get some really cheap funding? So yeah, I think that they never came out and said it. They said, oh, we didn't need the money. And just about every bank came out and said that. We didn't need this money. They gave us some malarkey about, or we want to test the plumbing, make sure that the loan process worked. We're doing the Federal Reserve a favor by testing the plumbing of the financial system to make sure that when we apply for the loan, everything works okay and we get the cash.
When we flush your dollars down the toilet.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the plumbing analogy can get really raunchy, but, and I won't pursue it, but I think that you did have a combination of, at times, needing the money in order to get over a rough patch, and at other times just taking advantage of some really cheap money that, if you're a banker, well, if you're anybody, if I said to you, I'll give you a $15 billion loan and I won't charge you for it, why not?
So you also talk about this issue of saving. You referred to savings accounts before. I think you use grandma as your grandma's deposits, and what the banks are doing with them. We have FDIC, this Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, that's supposed to basically insure our deposits up to $250,000. putting that together with what you've just said, you know, the questions as to the health of the banks, I'd like to ask you, are our deposits safe? Is the FDIC safe, secure?
I don't know. I would like to believe so. But I think that you're starting to really put your finger on the heart of the problem of too big to fail. You see, we had something called Glass-Steagall. That was a law from the 1930s, from the Depression, from the stock market crash. And what it said was, you have one bank for deposits, for grandma, as I say, and the other bank is for the casino. And that's where bankers can underwrite equities, they can underwrite bonds, they could buy credit default swaps or collateralized debt obligations. And they could roll the dice at the casino, the financial casino. And so we had a separation, we had a wall between the deposits and the casino. And in 1999, Bill Clinton signed a law that said, we're going to just wipe out the wall. There was a little bit of a protection in the Federal Reserve Act. And I go into that in some detail in the book. Let's suffice to say that the Federal Reserve did all it could to erase that protection between the casino and grandma's account. Because that's really what we're talking about, is that savings accounts are a really cheap way for the bank to fund itself. It hardly pays any interest on a certificate of deposit or a savings account. And that's how the bank funds its forays into the casino. That's okay now. It didn't used to be okay. It's okay now, and the Federal Deposit Insurance, the FDIC, does not like that, because what the FDIC ends up doing is it ends up, as you can see, guaranteeing the bank at the casino. If the bank's using deposit money at the casino and that money's lost, then the FDIC's on the hook to pay back the depositors.
So I'm getting a picture here. The U.S. taxpayer is basically insuring 9 out of 10 mortgages, and the FDIC is now insuring the casino. Where's this money coming from?
It's coming from us. We seem to have a lot of it, and we seem to have a lot of combined. I mean, I don't have a lot of money in my wallet, but the $10 that I have in the checking account or the savings account combines with your $10, combines with 300 million other accounts, and it ends up being a lot of money. So I guess it's kind of an awkward way of saying this, and that is that what happened since the financial crisis, and why I write about a subversion of democracy, is that private obligations became public obligations. So heads I win, tails you lose. If the bank makes money, the bankers get the money. The bankers get the profit. If the bank loses money, taxpayer makes up for it. This is the essence of too big to fail and why too big to fail is considered unfair.
And we're talking with Bob Ivry. He's a financial reporter with Bloomberg, and his book is The Seven Sins of Wall Street. You also go into the so-called London Whale case. Who was the London Whale and what was involved? And what does this tell us about the banking system?
The London Whale was a trader in London named Bruno Ixel. And he, as I referred to earlier, he lost on a bet, on many bets, at least $6.2 billion with a B. B as in boy. We don't know how much he lost, because what J.P. Morgan Chase, his employer, did was it swept all of his accounts into a general fund. So if it was more than $6.2 billion, we don't know. What it says about the... And he did this in an investment office in London for one of the world's biggest banks, J.P. Morgan Chase. The most celebrated CEO on Wall Street, Jamie Dimon, leads this bank. And I think what it says is that if we believe the press about Jamie Dimon, that he's the most capable, smartest, savviest CEO on Wall Street, that if he runs a bank that can go rogue on him in such a costly way, what are we to say about any of these banks with 250,000 employees in 160 countries playing with other people's money every day, We want them to take risks. We want them to find ways to invest the money that may or may not pay off. We want them to do these things. Do we want them to do it with customer deposits? No. Do we want them to do it with impunity if they do something illegal? No. Do we want them to make lots of money? Why not? Do we want them to make lots of money at the expense of taxpayers? No. So readers of The Seven Sins of Wall Street will may get the idea that I don't see anything wrong with banking, that traditional banking should be boring. There should be a separation between the deposits and the investment bank. The investment bankers should roll the dice. Risk is a big part of the United States, of capitalism, of progress, of finding something like an internet startup and putting money in it, watching it grow and do great things. There's nothing wrong with that. In fact, we should nurture that. Should we nurture that on the backs of people like Rebecca Black, an Army veteran who lost her home because of a bad mortgage? Should we do it on the backs of people like the Lacys, who were up to date on all their mortgage payments but were still foreclosed on by Bank of America? No. We should find a way that if a bank fails, the taxpayers aren't on the hook. That the bank should be small enough to fail where the stakeholders, like the shareholders, lose everything. The employees might lose their jobs. It might be a horrible thing for a lot of people, but it's not a horrible thing for everybody.
And I want to come back to that, but there's one thing we haven't talked about yet, and that is the banks are not only started trading in these in the casino, as you talk about it, you know, these new abstruse financial instruments, but they've also now gone heavily into commodities, in which they're bringing the casino to the things that we need just to live on. You know, the aluminum that goes into our tin cans, you know, commodities, agricultural commodities. I'd like you to talk about this, and you mentioned J.P. Morgan. J.P. Morgan was caught with this whole thing happening in Detroit where they own these warehouses for aluminum and they're shuttling the aluminum from one warehouse to another in order for the price to go up. Explain what this is all about and why this is a kind of a new danger that is now posed to us.
I think you meant Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs owns the warehouses in Detroit.
I'm sorry, it was J.P. Morgan was playing with electricity in California. Yeah.
Yes. J.P. Morgan was slapped for rigging the electricity market in California, and Goldman Sachs has been under scrutiny for allegedly manipulating the price of aluminum by bringing it into warehouses and a lot of it into warehouses and then letting just a very thin stream of it come out. I think that this is one area where since the publication or since I wrote the book and since the book's come out, it's gotten a little bit better because the prices of commodities have come down a little bit and the banks are getting a lot of heat for allegedly manipulating commodity prices. So J.P. Morgan agreed to sell its commodity unit. Goldman's staying in there. Goldman hasn't said anything about selling it. Morgan Stanley, also a big player in commodities, has said it's putting some of its commodity oil, its oil tanker company, up for sale. The financial press likes to say that, hey, the Federal Reserve's finally cracking down on the banks. What I think the bigger lesson here is that the banks can do whatever they want. The story that I recount in the book is about how the law says that banks can't get into the commodities business, right? Because they buy and sell the commodities themselves. So they can't get into the business of mining. They can't get into the business of oil tankers. They can't own warehouses for metals because they could
manipulate the price any way they want to.
It would make it much easier for them to manipulate. It would certainly give them a leg up on news if there's a shortage or there's a disaster at a mine, etc. What the Federal Reserve said to Citigroup in the early part of the 2000s and to J.P. Morgan a couple years later was, okay, you can get into the commodities business, just don't get into the transport and the warehousing of it. And then a couple years later, J.P. Morgan bought a warehouse company, and the Federal Reserve didn't say anything. But J.P. Morgan said, okay, we're going to get rid of it in a couple years. And then the Federal Reserve said, okay, we know you're gonna do what's right. And then could you do it by this date? And J.P. Morgan said, fine. And then when the date got close, J.P. Morgan says, well, give us another year. And the Federal Reserve said, sure, another year. And then that date started to come. And J.P. Morgan said, well, give us another year. And the Federal Reserve said, sure. So if the financial press has any knowledge about this particular industry, they would know that the bank selling their commodities businesses has nothing to do with the Federal Reserve cracking down on them. It has to do with the heat that the public has put on them and regulators like the Energy Regulatory Commission, and also because, quite frankly, they're not as profitable as they once were.
So finally now to your prescription, which is to break up the banks. I think this is an old controversy in the history of America. Goes back to Jackson and maybe even Alexander Hamilton, who was one of the creator of the Federal Reserve. How could that actually be accomplished, you know, given the situation of regulatory capture that we have now? What kinds of pressures can be brought to bear to make that happen?
I think that saying that we ought to break up the banks is a heck of a lot easier than breaking up the banks. I think in some cases, the market is doing that for us. I think Morgan Stanley, for instance, which was the number two investment bank before the crisis, has gotten smaller. And they've recognized that they could run a very profitable business if they shrunk and concentrated on their brokerage, for instance, certain businesses that they were very good at. And before the crisis, the financial system, the financial sector, was just simply too large. It just had sucked too much of a percentage of our attention and our resources. So it had to shrink after the financial crisis. I think legislatively in 2010, a couple of senators, Democratic senators, got together and said, you know, let's limit banks to $500 billion in assets, which seems like a science fiction amount of money, right? It's Dr. Evil saying, you know, ha ha ha, $500 billion, you know, and then taking his jet to Skull Island. But the fact of the matter is you have a handful of banks with more than twice that in assets now. The banks just got bigger after the financial crisis. Now you have one of those Democratic senators, Sherrod Brown of Ohio and David Vitter of Louisiana, a Republican, who have legislation proposed that would do something similar. They would shrink the banks. I think that the only way that the Senate, even as I say it, I'm getting discouraged about it. I think that legislatively is one way to do it. And the problem does cut across Republican and Democratic lines. There are Republicans and Democrats who think that the big banks are the greatest thing in the world. And you can see their campaign contributions are, a lot of them are from Wall Street. But you also have Democrats and Republicans who think that they're too big. So from both parties, you could probably get a few votes to break up the banks. I don't think at this point you can get enough. What we can do is put our money in smaller banks and in credit unions and try not to do business with the biggest banks. I don't know what else to do. It seems kind of futile in a way. And it seems like I am letting people down by giving people a vision of all the problems and not really being strong on the cure for it. Let's throw the bums out of Washington. Let's have term limits in Washington. Let's make sure that the influence of money that the Supreme Court thinks is free speech is minimized as much as possible, because why did Ronald Biggs rob the banks? Well, that's where the money was, right? Why do the politicians do the bidding of the biggest banks? That's where the money is.
Well, this is a fascinating book, Bob Ivry, and it's been a fascinating discussion. There's so much more we could talk about, but we've really run out of time. The Seven Sins of Wall Street, Big Banks, Their Washington Lackeys, and the Next Financial Crisis. It's a terrific book, and I want to tell our listeners, too, it's absolutely a rip-roaring read. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. It's been fun.
Bob Ivry is an award-winning financial reporter for Bloomberg News. You can read an excerpt from The Seven Sins of Wall Street by going to writersvoice.net. Summer has arrived, and with it, the summer reading season. Whether you go to the beach, the mountains, or just put your feet up on the porch rail during your staycation, here are some books you might want to check out. After reading Bob Ivry's Seven Sins of Wall Street, you could follow up with Matt Taibbi's powerful new book, Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. Like Ivry, Taibbi has made covering Wall Street malfeasance his bailiwick, with an acidly funny pen that rivals Ivry's. But in Divide, he tackles the gross disparity in our system of criminal prosecution that targets the poor and powerless for minor and even non-existent crimes, while letting the big banksters go scot-free. It's a ferocious indictment of the American injustice system that will leave you outraged. Another shocking tale is told by Glenn Greenwald in No Place to Hide, Edward Snowden, the NSA, and the U.S. surveillance state. Greenwald, of course, is the journalist who blew Snowden off for months until documentarian Laura Poitras convinced him Snowden was the real deal. They went to Hong Kong together to meet the brilliant young whistleblower, and the world hasn't been the same since. Nowhere to Hide tells the gripping story of the Snowden revelations and details just how deep and wide Big Brother's penetration into every aspect of our electronic lives has become. Read it, then, in the immortal words of Mother Jones, don't mourn, organize. Summer is tick season, and Lyme disease rates continue to soar. There's a lot of controversy over whether the disease can turn chronic, but if you want an in-depth examination of the case for chronic Lyme, go no further than Dr. Richard Horowitz's book, Why Can't I Get Better? Horowitz covers how to detect Lyme, comorbidity with bacterial and other infections, Lyme's impact on the body, including the immune system, hormones, and the brain, and finally, treatment, including non-drug methods like exercise and meditation. In the thriller department, Swedish crime writer Camilla Läckberg's novel The Hidden Child turns on both historical and contemporary themes of right-wing extremism in Europe. The protagonist is a crime writer who delves into her traumatic past to uncover a dark secret linking a World War II-era murder to a contemporary neo-Nazi group. The novel is one of those formulaic but satisfying page-turners that leave you surfacing at the end with a sigh of guilty pleasure. Finally, the kids need to read, too. When I was what they now call a middle reader, my favorite books were of the fascinating facts variety, books that served up lots of tidbits of information with which I could satisfy my insatiable curiosity. Time, the kids' magazine, has published a series of these books. There's The Big Book of How and The Big Book of Why, and now The Big Book of When, 101 Facts Kids Want to Know. Covering such topics as time itself, animals, communication, energy, civilizations, and the digital age, among others, it's a colorfully illustrated book with engaging prose that will have your kids impressing friends and family. Have fun! That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox, or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.